Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
How do you turn a concert into a musical, into a film, into a book? Singer, songwriter, artist, and author David Byrne will be here to talk about his latest project, American Utopia. And how did the case of Sharonda Jones, a single mother sentenced to life in prison without parole, change the life of a young law student forever? Brittany Barnett will be here to discuss her book, A Knock at Midnight, a story of hope, justice, and freedom. Alexander Alter will have an update from the publishing world. Plus, our critics will join us for the latest in literary criticism. This is the Book Review Podcast from the New York Times. It's November 13th. I'm Pamela Paul. David Byrne joins us now. He is, of course, the musician, the filmmaker, visual artist, and here primarily as an author of a new book, American Utopia. He wrote it and it's illustrated together with Myra Kallman. David, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
This is obviously tied to a larger project, began as a concert tour, then a Broadway show, now a film directed by Spike Lee, and simultaneously a book. Can you talk to us a little bit, for those who aren't familiar with American Utopia, which I feel like I don't know who those people are at this point, but tell us about how you conceived of the project and the various forms in which it's appeared. And was it all like known from the beginning that it would be in these multiple formats?
Okay, going backwards, no, it was not conceived from the beginning that it would be all these multiple formats. I didn't imagine in the beginning that it would end up on Broadway, that that would be filmed. Sort of one thing leads into another. Okay, so in the beginning, I wanted to see if I could do a show where all the band members were mobile. I thought the technology might have arrived where that would be possible. And it also required that I would have a sufficient budget, because that would mean I would have to turn, say, a drummer into six different players, all playing drums and percussion instruments, kind of like a drum line or a samba school or something like that. And I realized, okay, that's more personnel. Can I afford that? I could. So I went ahead with this, which opened up opportunities for staging and choreography and movement and then lighting and everything else. Things just followed. Once one thing was kind of accomplished or decided, then the door would open and you go, okay, that means that then we can do this. And now we can do this, et cetera, et cetera. And so at some point during the tour, I kind of got wind that Broadway producers had seen the show and thought, probably, I'm going to guess, in response to the success of Bruce Springsteen's show, people thought, oh, this can go to Broadway. This could go to Broadway. And Broadway audiences are ready for this kind of thing now. This is a thing that can be done. Very, very different than Bruce Springsteen's show. But I think the idea was that whatever popular music, contemporary music could work on Broadway, things didn't have to be all Broadway music. I wrote additional things for the Broadway version, extended it, reshaped it. I knew that a Broadway audience would kind of come with different sets of expectations, but also kind of an opportunity for me to talk more, to kind of shape the show in a different way, kind of address things that you may not address in a concert tour where people basically just want to dance and have a lot of fun. The director, Alex Timbers, was helping out. And he said, David, you know, you could maybe have a drop curtain here. And that in a certain kind of way, when the audience is coming in and they're staring at the stage and the curtain is down, in some ways you can have an image that sort of prepares them in a way for what's coming.
Enter Myra Kallman.
Yes. And Alex showed me kind of an old graphic that he probably got off the internet that was sort of like the 50 states and what each state is known for. And this was maybe done like in the 40s or 50s or something like that. It looked like a school thing.
What were your favorite states? Because you're laughing.
I'm laughing because, you know, you can imagine that some of them are corn and some of them are mining or some of them are cattle or, oh, yes. And so it was also folklore from each state. So there'd be Paul Bunyan or Casey Jones, John Henry, all these American kind of myths and legends were in there. And I thought, okay, ooh, I didn't want to do that exactly, but I thought, that's a nice direction. Thank you, Alex. So I went to Myra, whom I'd worked with before many, many, many years ago, and said, would you be interested in doing drawings and paintings for this curtain?
You worked with Myra Kalman back in 1987 on a picture book called Stay Up Late. That was, of course, the lyrics from that song from the album Little Creatures.
She had done a backdrop once, I think, for, might have been a dance performance. So this was not completely out of her wheelhouse. She kind of knew that. So, and I showed her the American folklore map thing. And I said, yeah, I want to kind of represent the kind of diversity and humanity of what we're referencing in this show. And so she started working on it. We traveled up to Yonkers where the thing would be laid out and printed and went through all this technical stuff. And we were both thrilled with the result. Then had the idea, well,
let's take this curtain and turn it into a book.
Yes, let's turn this into a book. And the original idea was, oh, could we do this really quickly? And should it be a poster or a little book or what should it be? Could we make a little souvenir item if people kind of love these drawings and like the way that it kind of, in some ways, embodies what the show is about. Maybe they'd like to have something like that to take home. And, well, these things take a little longer than maybe we thought. And, of course, the show kind of went on hiatus because another show was coming in. And then the pandemic hit. But here we are with the book that Alex Kalman designed, pairing Myra's drawings with some of the things I say in the show, little snippets of lyrics, and it works really well. It really does capture a lot of the feeling of the show.
So if Alex Kalman did that original pairing of your lyrics together with Myra's drawings, where were you in this process in terms of, did you come in and say, well, actually, let's not do that line, let's do this one, or let's pair these words with this drawing, or how did you work on the project?
I knew Alex mainly through his museum project, you know, the tiny little museum on, I think, Cortland Alley. It's a museum in a elevator shaft, and it's really good. you tell people what it is, and they go, huh? And then you go, it's really good. Yes. So at that point, I was really enjoying what they were doing, the pairings they were making, and I think Myra did some extra drawings for the book to make it graphically kind of flow better. My only comment at some point was, make sure you preserve the diversity that we see on stage. Make sure that that happens in the book as well.
In the show, you start out on stage alone. And of course, you end out there, all of the band members among the audience. And there's this real, not just connection, but almost unity that exists between the people who are once on the stage, including you, and the people in the audience. And I'm curious if you thought about, well, how do you capture that kind of intimacy and connection in a book form? Or do you even try?
Well, it's never going to be the same. You can't kind of duplicate things from one medium and just transfer them to another. But I think with what Myra and Alex have done, I guess my words help a little bit, they've captured a lot of what that feels like.
You're a songwriter, a performer. You have your choice of art form and medium. And I'm curious what it is that draws you to writing a book, as say writing a song or working on a film or TV score. What's the appeal?
The appeal comes from trying to be honest about the medium that you're using. to convey something, or trying to use the best medium to convey whatever it is you're trying to communicate. In some cases, that might be whatever, an essay, the idea you want to convey, whether it's about politics or policy or some sort of idea, might be best conveyed in an essay. And you might think that's not something that you can write a song about. You could try, and people have done such things, but it generally does not succeed. But there's things that a song can do that other mediums can't do. A song, for example, can have two sort of conflicting ideas or hold two opposing ideas at the same time, which is hard to do in a book. A song, for example, the melody can be buoyant and joyous, but the words can be kind of melancholy. That's not unusual at all. I mean, there's plenty of examples of that, where there's just this gorgeous, gorgeous, uplifting melody, but the words are actually sometimes kind of tragic. And the tension between those two things is what makes it really work, because it's like, this is what life is. Life is a balance between these two things. So you can do that in a song, and it's really hard to do that in a book, because a book is very linear that way, especially text. But sometimes with pictures and text, you can kind of have different things going on.
Get at that tension.
Yeah.
You know, it reminds me of something I heard you say in another interview, talking about a song that you wrote, and the lyrics were about people coming into your house. And this was a song that was then reinterpreted and sung by a group of, I think, music students in Detroit, or a musical group in Detroit. And that you were saying in this interview that when you sang it, it had this, the way that you sung it, it was like, oh no, people are coming into my house and sort of intruding on me. But that when they sang it, it was like this incredibly welcoming, totally different mood, that they interpreted the words to have this very different take.
That really struck me, that the same song interpreted as just slightly differently can have a very, very different meaning.
One of the reasons I bring that up, too, is because, of course, in this show, you sing a song written by Janelle Monáe that's gotten a lot of attention. Walter Scott, say his name. Walter Scott, say his name. Walter Scott, say his name. Walter Scott, won't you say his name? Jermaine Reed, say his name. Jermaine Reed, say his name. Jermaine Reed, say his name. Jermaine Reed, won't you say his name? And now let's hear your version of that Janelle Monáe song.
Walter Scott.
Say his name.
Walter Scott.
Say his name.
Jermaine Reed.
Say his name.
Jermaine Reed.
Say his name.
Jermaine Reed.
What did you want to bring to your interpretation of this piece?
To be honest, I didn't feel like I wanted to interpret it that much. I wanted it to be pretty faithful to what she had done. I felt like not enough people had heard that. This deserves to be better known. It's such an amazing thing that she did. I love a drum line, and that kind of thing that she's referencing with all that percussion comes out of kind of the football and drum line traditions in the South. So as I thought, what's going to be different is maybe not so much the music as the fact that I'm the one saying it, and the whole band is doing it. And so it probably does change the meaning a little bit, having this slightly older white man doing this song rather than a younger Black woman.
It gets to the theme of the show, the sort of interconnectedness and human community and unity across those 50 states. The other major thing that to me comes across in American Utopia, both the show and the book and the movie, is the joy and optimism. And to me, that feels very out of sync with our times. But I know that your work in recent years, from your website, Reasons to Be Cheerful, to this project, has really focused on that. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the reasons behind that.
Some of that is self-therapy. It's easy to fall into anger and despair and anxiety, given what we can read in the papers every morning, all the stuff we're barraged with, and our natural inclination to be sort of more attracted to bad news. And I thought, let me see if we can begin by helping myself, by finding instances where maybe things are not as bad as you think they are. And I started to find a surprising number of those things. And I thought, I'm going to start posting these and making them so that other people can be aware of this, and maybe it'll help them as well. When things seem completely hopeless, you just become paralyzed. You can't move forward if you think things are just horrible. But you can be realistic. You cannot have a kind of Pollyanna kind of idea. But at the same time, yes, you can feel like, no, there are solutions out there. And there are people who are finding those solutions. And we should kind of celebrate that and emulate those. So, yeah, became kind of a lifesaver for me.
So it worked.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a constant struggle, though.
I was going to say that the pandemic is something that has made a lot of people feel kind of stuck, literally, metaphorically. And I'm curious if it's affected your creative processes in any way, positive or negative.
Oh, yes, it's had a huge effect. Yes. I have not written very many songs during the pandemic. You would think it would be a perfect subject because it's kind of pulled back the curtain on a lot of things and made us kind of look at our lives in a different way. And I think that will come. But my creative impulses went in a different way. I started doing drawings. I sort of continue to write for reasons to be cheerful when I can. I'm not as fast a writer as some. But yeah, a lot of it went into drawings and things. So that was kind of unexpected.
What have you been drawing?
Well, these little pen and ink drawings. I call them dingbats. they were originally meant to be little illustrations that would go into the Reason to Be Cheerful journalistic pieces that we do to break up big blocks of type. The way typographers and magazine layout people use little illustrations of maybe a flower pot or a teacup or whatever to kind of just add a little breathing space when there's a lot of text. And I got a little carried away with it. And the drawings became a little more elaborate than that. And yeah, I just kept doing them.
Well, obviously, I have a bias in terms of art forms, but what I'm seeing is the Book of Dingbats.
Oh, really?
Well, we'll have you back on the podcast to discuss that book when it does. David Byrne, such a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
This podcast is supported by the Shalom Hartman Institute. For decades, the Shalom Hartman Institute has been the preeminent destination for Jewish ideas and learning. The weekly Identity Crisis podcast with host Yehuda Kurtzer creates better conversations around issues facing contemporary Jewish life. For Heaven's Sake, the award-winning number one Judaism podcast with Daniil Hartman and Yossi Klein Halevi features thoughtful discussions on political and social trends in Israel and Israel-diaspora relations. Discover these chart-topping podcasts at shalomhartman.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Regular listeners of the podcast will know that we're getting close to that time of year when we announce our 10 best books, which is a very exciting time. You'll be able to hear it, of course, on the podcast November 27th. But if you want to hear it earlier and live, as in Zoom Live, you can sign up for a virtual event that will be held on November 23rd for New York Times subscribers. If you'd like to be there, albeit virtually, go to timesevents.nytimes.com to RSVP. My colleagues and I will be doing our usual thing, talking about the books that made the list, as well as getting a chance to wax rhapsodic about our personal favorites that didn't quite make the cut. This is one of our favorite podcasts and events of the year, so look forward to seeing you there. Brittany K. Barnett is the author of a new book. It's called A Knock at Midnight, A Story of Hope, Justice, and Freedom. She is also a lawyer and the founder of several organizations, including the Buried Alive Project, Girls Embracing Mothers, and Melena Rain, LLC. She joins us now from Dallas, Texas. Brittany, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So this is a very multi-layered story. It's the story, it's your own story. It's the story of a woman named Sharonda Jones. And it's also a larger story about criminal justice in this country. How did you kind of figure out what shape the book would take? Because it's sort of part memoir, but it's also a larger story. And it's a kind of close look at this individual, Sharonda Jones.
Yes, I knew that I wanted to use the book to tell the truth about racial inequality in this country and just how the nation's prisons are disproportionately filled with people of color. And I wanted to tell the truth about the human beings locked in America's cages. The human element is just so often ignored, but it's critical to drive impactful change. And to do that, I knew I had to tell these stories. And I just really wanted the readers to meet Sharonda and the other clients I talk about in the book and be impacted, honestly, you know, the way that I was when I met them in person.
And did you know that you would include your own personal story, your family story?
You know, that wasn't the plan at first when I began writing. And honestly, I didn't even think about it. And as I started talking with mentors and just people helping to guide me along the way, they were just encouraging me to tell my story as well, that it was a crucial part of my journey. And so I became really more open to that and went from there.
All right. We'll go back to that part of the story. But I want to start with Sharonda Jones, because that's where you really begin your book. Tell us a little bit about Sharonda and how you came across her story.
Sharonda Jones, she reminded me so much of myself. When I came across her case one night in law school in the law library, as I was researching a paper for critical race theory, and I wanted to really humanize my paper. I wanted to give a heartbeat to all the legalese and all the policy. And when I came across Sharonda's case, it just touched at my soul. She was so familiar to me, like my mom, you know, like me. Sharonda grew up in a small town just like me in East Texas. And she was just a regular person. And so she was just as familiar to me as my own reflection in the mirror. She made a mistake. You know, a mistake not so different than ones I had made as a teenager. And she was serving the second harshest punishment imaginable in America. And that was life without parole for her very minor role in a federal drug case.
How did that happen? Let's go back to the drug trade itself, to sort of what her role was, because she was really an intermediary. How did she get involved in that? And then let's take it from there and talk about why she ended up with that very strict punishment while the supplier and the buyer both got off with less than 8 years.
Sharonda had dreams, goals, and ambitions. She was an entrepreneur. She owned her own small hair salon and her own small burger joint in the small town. And she was just surviving. She was taking care of her quadriplegic mother, her daughter. And then she made a mistake. She needed extra money. And so she connected two drug dealers that she knew and drove drugs up the interstate between Dallas and Houston for these drug dealers, for which she very nearly paid with her entire life.
Why did she get that very severe sentence and the other two got off with such little time by comparison?
Sharonda, number one, she utilized her constitutional right to go to trial. And unfortunately, with that comes what we call in the legal world, the trial penalty. The government is going to come after you with everything that they have.
Why is that?
You know, it seems with the child penalty, they get frustrated, you know, for having to use their resources and time to go to trial and prosecute these cases and prove beyond a reasonable doubt, you know, the elements of the crime. It seems very frustrating for them. And we see it across the country. This child penalty is a real thing. And if you're not pleading guilty and you're going to trial, it often comes with very, very severe and stiff penalties.
So this is the result of not accepting just a quick plea bargain and moving on.
Absolutely. It's a result of that. And it's a result of the catastrophic failure of the war on drugs and the harsh punishment that was implemented through that law in shape of the 100-to-1 ratio, honestly. And what that means is there's a disparity between crack cocaine and powder cocaine sentencing. And I could have 5 grams of crack cocaine. You could have 500 grams of powder cocaine, and we would receive the same sentence in prison. And it's not lost on anyone, especially in 2020, but in particular at the end of the 80s when these laws were put in place, that more affluent white people were using powder cocaine and crack cocaine was running rampant through communities of color, in particular communities with Black people. And so these laws just created this grossly disproportionate number of people of color serving sentences for drugs.
So she decides not to accept a plea bargain. She decides to go to trial. What was her thinking? What was she going to argue in front of the judge?
Sharonda Jones had no idea what she was into. She had never been in trouble before. She had never even received a traffic ticket before. She had no idea how the system works. And she was charged with this overreaching offense of federal drug conspiracy. And with her ignorance of the law, she did not believe she was guilty of conspiracy.
She gets this sentencing of life without parole. The other two parties involved, how did they get off with less than 8 years?
They testified against Sharonda at her trial and received lesser sentences in exchange for their testimony. So you have a case here where the drug supplier, who admittedly trafficked multiple kilograms of powder cocaine, testified against Sharonda Jones, who was trafficking drugs for him. And she received a fundamental death sentence, and he received less than 10 years in prison.
All right. So you read about this case as a law student in the library. Ultimately, you get involved with it. How did that happen? I mean, did you reach out to her right away? How did you become involved in Sharonda Jones's case?
I reached out to her right away. Her case just tugged at my soul. And I had experienced the incarceration of my own mom. So I knew what that was like. And I just felt a kindred spirit to Sharonda. And I sent her a card, honestly, and told her I was a law student and I wanted to help her get out of prison.
Did she respond?
She did. And it was such a nonchalant, cool response, wishing me well in my studies. But you could tell she had been let down a lot by lawyers over the years. At that time, she had been in prison for 10 years.
So what did you do then?
I wrote her back and I went to visit her in person. And we had the most remarkable visit. It was as if we were family, and our journey began from there.
All right. I don't want to give away the whole entire story, but tell us a little bit more. What did you then do on her behalf?
I began to try to get Sharonda Jones out through the courts. I graduated law school and went on to practice corporate law. So I was literally moving deals by day and working on Sharonda's case pro bono at night, and just started getting so frustrated because every avenue I tried through the court, we were blocked. And I began to just feel like, as lawyers, we are forced to work within the bounds of laws that are just outside the bounds of moral consciousness. And there was absolutely no way for Sharonda Jones to receive relief from her life sentence through the court. And so from there, I came across what would be Sharonda Jones's only hope for freedom. And that was executive clemency from the president. And so we began the journey of trying to plea to President Barack Obama to save Sharonda Jones's life.
I'd love for you to give us an example of one of the egregious ways in which you felt that our own justice system perpetuated injustice. You talked about the racial bias inherent in the discrepancies between crack cocaine and powder cocaine. What's another example?
Another example is when I was trying to get Sharonda out through the courts. The laws were beginning to change. There was a change in attitude about this crack cocaine and powder cocaine disparity and how just unfounded and racially biased it was. And so as the laws were beginning to change, I was getting excited. Sharonda was getting excited. Now we have a way to get her through the court. But then we find out those laws aren't retroactive. So that's another way that we find ourselves at a crossroads. And so we have people serving life sentences today under yesterday's drug laws.
All right. I want to step away from Sharonda's story and go back to your mother's story, because you brought that up. And you said at the beginning that initially you didn't intend to write about that. Were you scared to write about your mother's story? Were you protective? What were your feelings around digging into that as part of this book?
I was very protective. You know, my family is my greatest source of inspiration to this day. They mean everything to me. And going back to write about my story would mean that I would need to look deep within myself and deep within my past. And I knew that if I was going to write about myself, I was going to tell my story in the purest, most authentic way. And that would open up to the world the fact that my mother suffered from a very severe crack cocaine addiction, the fact that my mother had gone to prison, and loving my mother the way that I do. You know, I was very protective of that.
What was that like for you growing up?
I honestly had a very happy childhood. It was devastating, of course, growing up with a mother with a growing addiction to drugs, because as a child, you know, you're seeing disaster unfold a tiny arm's reach away, and you want to fix her. I wanted to fix her and help her and save her, and not realizing as a child that that wasn't my burden to bear, and I couldn't fix her. But even with that, my sister and I knew that my mom loved us. We knew that our family loved us. And I even opened the book with an excerpt from the Nikki Giovanni poem, Nikki Rosa, in which she writes the line, "Black love is black wealth." And they'll probably talk about my hard childhood and never understand that all the while I was quite happy. And that quote from that poem just resonated so much with me. My family is my heart and backbone, and I am because they are.
Were they in part the inspiration, the motivation for you to go to law school to begin with?
You know, they always encouraged me to go after my biggest dreams. And I had always wanted to be a lawyer. As a little girl, I wanted to be like Claire Huxtable from The Cosby Show. You know, growing up in my small piece of rural East Texas, there were no lawyers in my community. And there certainly weren't any Black women lawyers. And so I kind of lost sight of that dream until I got older and just had life experience to realize I could accomplish this dream. And my family poured into me, you know, and encouraged me along the way. And, you know, that's another reason I wrote the book. I want all the little Southern girls and Southern girls of color, you know, with big lawyer dreams or whatever their big dream may be, to read my book and hopefully see themselves in me and know that they can do anything.
I want to go on to talk about one of the organizations, just one of the organizations that you founded, Buried Alive, which is quite a name. How did that come about? And tell us about that name.
The Buried Alive Project came about early 2017. In 2016, I had resigned from my corporate job to really follow my passion to transform the criminal justice system and wasn't sure which direction I should go. But seeing by then, President Barack Obama had graciously granted clemency to Sharonda Jones, And seeing how she and my other client, Corey Jacobs, had kind of this survivor's remorse because they were now free, but they had left behind so many people in prison that they knew were just as deserving of freedom as they were. And so we linked arms, and together, Sharonda and Corey and I co-founded the Buried Alive Project to provide pro bono legal representation for people serving life sentences under these outdated federal drug laws. And we work to end the policies that put them there. And so the name of Buried Alive is just that. These people are set to die in prison.
I just want to say at this point, 7 of your clients have won clemency from President Obama. So clearly a success to date. Do you plan to keep writing about your work?
I do. You know, I really think it's important that we tell our stories, that we tell our own stories, because history shows the dangers when we leave that task to someone else. And I look forward to just helping to correct false narratives, helping to shift the paradigm about the amazing human beings who are victims of the war on drugs, and truly driving impactful change that is so desperately needed in America's criminal legal system.
Well, Brittany, thank you for the work you do and for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Brittany K. Barnett is the author of A Knock at Midnight, A Story of Hope, Justice, and Freedom. Alexandra Alter joins us now with some news in the publishing world. Hey, Alexandra.
Hey, Pamela.
You've got some big news today.
Yes, we are entering what is turning out to be a huge season for publishing news. There's the Booker Prize and the National Book Awards are coming up next week, and the long-awaited memoir from former President Barack Obama, which is shaping up to be probably among, or perhaps the top-selling presidential memoir of all time. And it's going to provide, hopefully, a huge boost to booksellers who've really been struggling this year with the pandemic and shutdown. So already we're seeing incredible demand for this book. There have been so many pre-orders that Crown, which is Mr. Obama's publisher, has bumped up its first printing from 3 million copies to 3.4 million copies. And because of the constraints on the print market, with the printers being at capacity this year, they actually are printing 1.5 million of those copies in Germany and bringing them over on shipping containers. So they're really drawing on their whole global infrastructure to overcome these real obstacles in the supply chain that have only gotten harder with the pandemic. So just in another sign of how big a deal this book is, the Booker Prize actually moved its award ceremony to clear out for President Obama's publication. They were originally going to happen on the same day, and now the Booker is happening 2 days later. So of course, as with any highly anticipated political book, there have already been leaks, there have been excerpts, and we have some reviews coming in. So I think after a really tough year for booksellers, although the publishing industry has been doing quite well, we're seeing some positive signs that they could close out, if not where they were last year, they can certainly recover some of the lost revenue from this year.
So I assume we'll hear more about the book itself on next week's podcast.
We'll hear more about the book itself. And Mr. Obama is starting, I think, a pretty robust media tour. So people will be hearing directly from him as well. He's planning to go on Oprah Winfrey's show. He'll be on 60 Minutes, CBS Sunday morning, and is planning to do a bunch of podcasts and sort of youth-focused media interviews as well. He also has his own extensive social media following. But of course, you know, this is a pandemic. So I think what he would have originally planned in terms of a book tour, if you look at what Michelle Obama did, she had sold out arenas in Brooklyn and Chicago with tens of thousands of people in the audience. So obviously he's not going to be able to do any events like that, and probably nothing in person for his book tour. So he'll be really focusing on doing media and doing possibly some virtual events as well.
Well, probably easier to get tickets.
Yeah, that's true.
All right, Alexandra, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us now are critics Jennifer Salai and Parle Sagal. Hi, guys.
Hi, Pamela.
Let's talk about what books you all reviewed this week, starting with you, Parle.
I reviewed a book called The Walker by Matthew Beaumont, and it's a history of writers walking and sort of links between movement and creativity. These kinds of books are generally catnip for me, and I will read almost all of them. And I didn't mention this in the review, but I actually injured myself randomly. I'm very clumsy. And so I've been kind of bedbound for the last, I mean, not as if I'm not always pretty bedbound, but even more bedbound this week and the last. And reading this book about sort of the history of walking and writers' long associations with walking was bittersweet. You know, I long to be out there and up and around, but it's in many ways, it follows a very similar trajectory that many of these books take. You know, it talks about, you know, Dickens, who used to walk, he used to think nothing of walking, you know, 30 miles into town for breakfast and walk all night and composing, and Twain, who was a compulsive pacer, Virginia Woolf. And, you know, it sort of twists and sort of takes a different turn and says, you know, it doesn't do the thing that many of these books, I'm thinking of like Rebecca Solnit's book on walking, the other books do, sort of looking at this idea of like going out into the world and bringing back something to the desk. But it looks at the sort of jaundiced writerly consciousness of the sort of sullen writer, the sulky writer, or their character out in the city responding, feeling wounded by the city, wounded by modernity, to sort of make a case for a particular kind of writer as what Beaumont calls the indicator species, this sensitive creature that tells us, you know, upon whom all, you know, modernity or capitalism's excesses and depredations weigh on. And they write these books that are telling us about the wages of our age. And, you know, it's a bit, I mean, my review was pretty mixed. You know, there's a lot I enjoyed and admired about the book. It's abundance, it's amplitude. It reminds you of the city. But I think he skirts some important questions. You know, he wants to also look at how we walk now. How do we walk now? We walk hunched over our iPhones and in these cities that have been taken over by these corporate behemoths that are unwelcoming to us. But, you know, I wanted him to ask more questions, I think, about who the city belongs to. The city has not always belonged to everybody. You know, the public space, it's a concept that applies only to a particular kind of citizen. And he sort of dodges some of the more, these naughtier questions. But otherwise, like, I think it's a really interesting and kind of in many ways original addition to this genre.
Since, as you say, that this is a sort of Parul Sehgal subspecialty, books about walkers and books about writers, like, what's the best one that you've read or your favorite?
Oh, gosh. The best thing ever written about writing and creativity is Virginia Woolf's Street Haunting. And it's an essay that begins with her needing a pencil. And so she goes out and she talks about why it's important to walk in the city, what it means for women specifically to walk in the city. I think she has this great line about you leave this self that's encrusted with obligation at home and you can slip into being something else and someone else. I think that's the most beautiful book. Baudelaire writes beautifully about walking in the city, and I think it's upon a lot of his writings that Beaumont depends. Rebecca Solnit's book, Wanderlust, is also a book that I used to really, really enjoy. She has a line in it that, you know, some problems can't be sorted out at the desk. You know, you have to actually physically walk and think through them. And she has lots of interesting parallels between the rhythm of walking and the rhythm of thinking and of prose that I still return to and think about. And I, when I'm not sort of nursing my wounded foot and ego, you know, I do find that walking is a very helpful thing to do while writing.
You know, I went for a walk yesterday to clear my head. And as I was walking on the phone, and of course, I was on a walk and talk, which I guess defeats the purpose and is probably not in any of those excellent books, I nearly stepped onto like a freshly dead, like barely dead squirrel lying in the street, which I don't know. Somehow it felt like a metaphor for 2020. It's probably not part of that ideal scenario you're discussing.
It would. I think Woolf would have gotten a bunch of essays out of that.
I just imagined all kinds of gruesome alternatives had I actually stepped on that squirrel. Jen, what did you review?
So this week I reviewed a book. The title is How to Make a Slave, and it's a collection of personal essays by a writer named Gerald Walker, and this is his third book. It's actually been nominated as a finalist for the National Book Awards this year, and I guess the virtual ceremony is coming up in a couple of weeks. And so the title comes from the famous line from Frederick Douglass, "You have seen how a man was made a slave, you shall see how a slave was made a man." What he does with that in the title essay is that the whole thing is very short. It's like 6 or 7 pages. It's told in the second person present tense, and it sort of follows along his own experience in such a way where you're sort of experiencing things with him. And, you know, he brings this sense of humor and sort of a lightness of touch to subjects that are really intense and heavy to sort of show, to a certain extent, like how, you know, one's own experience changes from moment to moment. So your understanding of what happens to him changes. And there was something about this collection, what I really enjoyed about it was that there's never really sort of a declarative sense of, okay, this is exactly how the world is, and this is what my experience was like. It's always changing for him. I think it's one of those collections where it really, you almost have to experience it to really sort of understand the way that it moves, because it really does move, and it's very short. I mean, the whole thing with the number of essays in it is only, it's under 200 pages. So I was really quite moved by the whole thing.
Do you get the sense that he's in conversation with other writers in this genre? You mentioned Douglass, but I'm thinking of like Ta-Nehisi Coates or other people that have written similar sorts of books.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting because I would say that the quality of these essays, even though they are essays, they almost read like short stories. I mean, they're very much, you know, they're very tightly personal. There is sort of a sense of what's going on in the larger world. I mean, that's also something that infuses it. But you also get the sense that he's constantly thinking of how the ending, rather than sort of summing up his experience, it sort of opens up to new possibilities. I also thought Edward P. Jones, who also sort of encapsulates these moments and experiences in such a way where you end it, and rather than thinking, okay, well, this is the world and this is how it is, it sort of opens up another vista. So I was surprised by it. And I had previously actually read Walker's first memoir, Street Shadows. And, you know, that's a book, it's an interesting book. It's about his experiences as a father, a professor, a husband, but it also talks a lot about his younger years and the problems that he had with drugs. And so just to sort of have this body of work and sort of see how this writer has sort of processed his own experience, which has encompassed, you know, is just so capacious, I guess, was just really fascinating to me.
So I want to pick up, before we end, on a conversation we had a few weeks ago about people we would love to hear read aloud their own audiobooks, people who dead or alive. And that conversation began with a question from one of our listeners. And after we had that conversation, I got a number of emails from listeners wanting to offer up their own suggestion. And I thought I would share a few of those letters here. So Jen, you were talking about a National Book Award finalist. Nathan Dees recommends a National Book Award winner. He writes, "I heard your recent conversation about audiobooks and wanted to add that Elizabeth Acevedo's The Poet X is an incredible audiobook. Since the book is told in slam poetic meter, Acevedo's read provides such a powerful performance of the text. It's also not the longest audiobook, weighing in at just 3.5 hours. I highly recommend for your listeners of teen and middle years, but also adults interested in experimental storytelling and poetry." All right, I'm going to give you another one. This one comes from, this is actually a very long email with many excellent suggestions, so I'm only going to read a few of them. This is from Eric Sirota. He says, "Since I save up my NY Times Book Review podcasts and listen to a few while I walk around Vienna on weekends," speaking of walking, let's walk in Vienna, Pearl, can we? That sounds very nice right now. I'm just going to list a few of the books he talks about. He says the first audiobook he bought was a collection of Philip Roth stories in 1998, which he read while spending a few weeks in Romania and stopping in Budapest. He also recommends Kapsa Kasabova's Border, which is a book about the Bulgarian, Greek, and Turkish borderland. On the back roads of Bosnia and Herzegovina, he listened to Jefferson Mays reading Alexander Hammond's The Lazarus Project. Julian Borger's The Butcher's Trail, about chasing war criminals after the Balkan Wars. I don't know where he listened to that. He says even better was listening to Tim Butcher read The Trigger, his story of Gavrilo Princip and his ill-started journey to Belgrade. I want to listen to all of these books while being in these places. The next person who wrote was Leif Jensen. He says, my two cents on great audiobooks are two by James McBride, Deacon King Kong and The Good Lord Bird. The books are read by Black artists that really capture these moments in history. Their love of these books is reflected in the audio reading that goes far beyond the normal reading I could do myself. And then Lynn Chase sends in a list of people who read their own work, and she calls these particular ones fabulous. Bill Bryson, Oliver Sacks, Sarah Vowell, David Sedaris, and Stephen King, especially his book on writing. And that's from Lynn Chase in Seattle. So I just thought I would share some of those to give people who want to get started on audiobooks some fresh ideas.
I mean, my version of that email is sort of like, I guess I listened to this on the couch, this one in the chair, this one on the bed, this one while cleaning. But no, that was a lovely email.
Let's run down the titles that you each read and reviewed this week, starting with you, Pearl.
I reviewed The Walker by Matthew Beaumont.
And I reviewed How to Make a Slave and Other Essays by Gerald Walker.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. And you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. I write back, not right away, but I do. The Book Review Podcast is produced by the great Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, with a major assist from my colleague John Williams. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.